You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this month's episode, I'm talking to a couple of creators who have worked in both film and comics. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Steph Hutchinson, a comic book writer and documentary filmmaker who has just written a new sequel comic, Demons 3, to the classic pair of Dario Argento and Lamberto Bava films from the 1980s, which have just been re-released on Blu-ray by Arrow Films in the UK. Before that, I'm talking to illustrator Dave McKean about his second feature film, The Gospel of Us, a recording of the live Port Talbot Passion Play starring Michael Sheen, which McKean filmed, edited, and has added his own special touches to, such as handwritten intertitles and animation, and I sat down to talk with him in a busy pub off Regent Street about the genesis of the project. How did your collaboration with the people who were putting on the St. Talbot Passion Play come about? Because presumably it had been running a few years before they decided to make a feature of it.
Michael Sheen was approached by National Theatre Wales to do something.
Right.
And I believe Michael was really not keen. And, you know, he didn't just want to do a play in Cardiff or something that would come and go. But as soon as he started talking to Lucy Davis, who runs the theatre company, she was very keen to take it out into the streets, out into the people, to do something big, expansive. And immediately Michael thought of the Passion Plays that he saw in Port Talbot when he was a child.
Okay.
But it had not happened for decades.
Oh, really? Oh, right.
And so he wanted to sort of resurrect it, as it were, in the town. And so he focused on that. And that very first image that he had in his mind, with extraordinary clarity, you know, apparently what he just sort of immediately said to Lucy was basically what they did in that first half hour of just ideas.
Yeah,
that's what they did. So they were going to put this thing on. I had got to know Michael through the possibility of doing a book together. He wanted to do a book.
Oh, okay.
And he's a big comics fan. And he knew my work, and he wanted to do a book that was part autobiography, part a sort of actor's journal. And he wanted it to deal with the three big roles in his life at that time. One of them was Hamlet, which he did at Young Vic. Amazing, amazing performance. One of them was Edgar Allan Poe, and he's written a film script with himself playing Poe. And I've read the script, and it's great. It'll be a great film. But one of them is playing this Christ-like figure, not Christ, but a Christ-like figure in a contemporary, secular passion play. And it all sounded amazing to me. And so, as part of the research for this, Michael went off to Germany, to Oberammergau, where they perform a passion play every 10 years, and have done since 1664, with the writer Owen Shears and the theatre director Bill Mitchell, the three of them. And I met them there, and of course they were just talking 10 to the dozen all the time about this theatre piece, and it sounded amazing. And I pitched in with my ideas as well. And by the end of it, by the end of the weekend, I just said, well, why the hell isn't anybody shooting this? This is crazy. You've got Michael Sheen, cast of thousands, an amazing location, one of the most powerful stories ever told, this great interpretation. Why isn't anybody making a film of this? And Bill Mitchell said, well, you do it. So I said, okay, I'll do it. So there we go. That was the extent of my pre-thought about doing it.
But obviously filming a live event is a completely different experience to something that's studio-bound, where you can think about every single set and the design and everything. So was it more that your influence was more evident in the post-production than it was in the actual live production on the streets?
Yeah, I mean, I'm credited as being the director. I didn't direct anything.
Right. Although, obviously, you chose camera angles.
Stuff happened.
Yeah.
And I had no input in the script or the performance of the actors, and I didn't really want to. I mean, that was the point for me. This thing was going to happen whether I was there or not, and whether my crew was there or not. And the only way we could shoot it at all was to enter a bargain agreement with the theatre company that we would not be present, we would not be apparent, we would not be getting in the way of the performance between the audience and the actors. Mm. It was primarily a theatre piece for the community, for the local community, and we could not interfere with that.
Yeah.
So we had to be very discreet.
Presumably on screen, whenever we see anyone with a camera, it's either going to be a member of your crew or a member of the public, and it's hard to tell which is which.
Well, everybody had a camera.
Yeah.
That was what we realised on the first scene. You know, I went to the rehearsals and I sketched out ideas of where I would like the angles to be and what I would like my cameraman to try and catch. But after the first scene, we just tore all that stuff up because thousands of people showed up. They were in awe unto themselves. And we very quickly realised that the essence of it was more like a documentary, grabbing this sort of historical moment.
Yeah.
And then it would be shaped later in editing. And then the presence of the crowd, there are massive faces and bodies, that's one, but also they were all shooting everything. They all had their iPhones and their mobile phones out. And so that feeling that you're watching something that is being recorded and interpreted and reimagined by all these people, this mass of people, that's the story. This story had to be told by them, for them, as much as I did any storytelling.
And there's a bit where Michael confronts someone with a camera and saying, you know, it's Precy, stop filming me and come with me. Was that unscripted? Because it seems, A, very apposite, and possibly to stretch a point, something that could be seen as a parallel to, say, the Rodney King BT, which is, you know, very famous for being filmed and not, you know, being helped.
Exactly. I mean, that moment was totally unrehearsed. Michael sort of went into this knowing that he's a famous person. This may be his hometown, but he's still a famous person. And so there would be an initial frisson of interest in this Hollywood star coming. And so everybody wants to take his photograph. But he wasn't ready for this barrage of mobile phones in his face and paparazzi in his face all the time. And so after the first scene, he was totally freaked out. He thought they failed because nobody is going to be able to relate to him as a fictional character. They're just relating to him as this famous film star. And it's going to wreck the whole piece.
But conversely, it actually works to its favour.
Well, I think it does. And what happened as he walks away from the first scene on his way into town to go to the next scene was he was trailed by a bunch of paparazzi and a bunch of other people as well, the members of the public, as he walked along the river into town. And meanwhile, I had got together with my cameraman. We'd all been totally freaked out by the fact that none of our plans worked. Paparazzi were getting in the way all the time. We were trying to be discreet and play by the rules, but we were getting nothing. We all thought we're screwed. We don't have a film here. So we said, OK, well, let's just get to the end of the day and we'll kind of recalibrate at the end of the day. But, you know, just for God's sake, just shoot stuff. Try and get stuff. You're going to have to be a bit more forceful. But, you know, don't push it, but try and be a bit more forceful. And one of our cameramen, a very, very experienced documentary filmmaker, realised that Michael was going to be surrounded by an army of paparazzi for the whole thing. So he took it upon himself to go up to one of them. He put his hand on his shoulder, on the shoulder of the paparazzi in front of him, and started filming Michael, almost obtrusively, to try and force the issue. And this lovely thing happened where Michael got an opportunity to express his frustration in character, and what he allowed him to say, what he hoped he would say, which was, if you're just looking through a piece of equipment, you're not in the moment, you're not really looking around at this beautiful place and this lovely weather and this beach and being with me and really being part of this moment. You're living for the future when you're thinking about your editing or your past, when you're thinking about your career. You're not here in this moment. And so he said all that, and my cameraman took the hint, backed off, and the other paparazzi kind of backed off as well, because this was now out in the open, and that became our sort of defining moment for that part of the film.
It's an interesting film for you to direct, because even though, like you said, it's a secular interpretation of the Passion, the last time we spoke was when you illustrated The Magic of Reality, which is a book that very much refutes religion, and it's all about just look at the world around us and look how magical it is anyway without any kind of theological interpretation. But then looking at your career in general, I guess you're someone who's always been interested in creation myths, as seen in Cages, for example. And so an interpretation of the Passion Play is perhaps, you know, very apposite for your career in general.
Yeah, the Magic of Reality is a book with Richard Dawkins, scientist, evolutionary biologist. So I'm fascinated by science, but I'm not a scientist. Mm. So the uncovering of facts about the world is Richard's end game. Mm. That's what it's all about for him. Mm. That's not really what it's about for me. I'm fascinated by the facts, but they're all raw materials for me, out of which I create stories and paintings, and I mulch them down in my imaginative life and create something else. And I have the same attitude to religion. Mm. I'm fascinated by religion. I'm not religious at all. I'm an atheist. I've never believed in anything supernatural or otherwise, or God, you know, God or any of those sorts of things. But I'm absolutely fascinated by the forces within us, this desperate need within us, humanity at large, to find something greater than ourselves.
Yeah.
Richard's point of view is all about, you know, the garden is an astounding place, the relationship between flowers and insects and the birds that are there and the cycle of the seasons. And it's miraculous and astounding and awe-inspiring in the true sense of the word. Mm. Do you really need fairies at the bottom of the garden as well to make it any more miraculous? And I completely agree with that. Mm. The thing about this telling of the story is that the miraculous was all around us there. People related to what Michael was doing. Mm. You know, the healing that he did was not supernatural. He wasn't making the blind see and the lame walk. Mm. He was just listening to people's stories and allowing them to tell their stories. Mm. And something about that was miraculous to a degree. It depends how you define the word miraculous. But it was extraordinary and it was empowering. And a lot of the local theatre groups that came to work on The Passion have taken away that spirit, that incredibly positive, empowering spirit. They're all now creating their own shows. They're working with each other. You know, it had a fantastically empowering effect on the town. Mm. And it gave people, you know, right now in Port Talbot, the seafront is pretty desolate. But there's a lot of plans to redevelopment. And you know damn well that people are going to be demanded to be listened to. That feeling, that spirit that we have to make this happen. We can't just let the politicians and the suits do this and pretend that they are knowledgeable and progress must march on and we must be docile. And we have to have a voice. Mm. We have to define our own future. Mm. That all came out of The Passion. Mm. It was there anyway. It was there already. But The Passion, for some reason, galvanized people and focused people. Mm. And maybe for the first time in a long while, they got a real sense of community and the force of a communal voice. Mm. And I hope that that's felt there. I would hope that that sort of thing would be true for anybody in any situation. Mm. It's a fantastic thing. That sort of, you rarely feel it. Michael has talked about it in terms of, you know, the feeling that people got was almost like a disaster. You know, when something really dreadful happens, you suddenly get communities pulling together and empathizing with each other and feeling for each other. But this one was in a really positive way. Not, you know, a disaster didn't happen. But that those same emotions, those same empathic feelings were galvanized. Mm. So it was extraordinary for me. Yeah.
Well, and it seems to have come at quite an extraordinary time in British culture, if not world culture, that this film, and it seems to be a bit of a reawakening of faith in Britain. I mean, if you listen to the Archbishop of Canterbury's speech a few days ago about how he was talking about the church can be there actually maybe as a voice to say, we need to put a stop on rampant economies that, you know, are kind of malevolent, and it's okay to have a belief and not ban, you know, crosses in people's workplaces. And so there seems to be very much a new debate about Christianity in this country, even though it is very much now a minority religion. And so the release of this film at the same time that there was, say, a BBC adaptation of The Passion last Friday and new Passion plays going on around the country. Do you see that debate going on that, you know, Christianity maybe not as a bigger force in our lives, but it's something that is now galvanizing a lot of debate that wasn't there even a year ago?
I think Christianity is in a very difficult position at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, they've tried to win certain arguments that they'll just never win, and there's no point in going up against, you know, scientific research about the age of the universe and the way evolution works. See, there's no point. And really, that's not what people want from faith and from the church, I think. Yeah. And I think if the church sort of recalibrates, not that I have anything invested in saving Christianity particularly, but if the church wanted a role at all,
yeah,
it's in community. Mm. It's in providing a neutral, nurturing, encouraging focus for local community. Mm. That's really the beginning and the end of it. Mm. I think church and state should be separate. Mm. I mean, I think the parallel with the Passion Play, and our Passion Play in Port Talbot particularly, the interesting parallel is what's going on in the Middle East with various revolutions that have taken place there. The fact that one person, disgruntled and frustrated by a life of being belittled, decides he's had enough, and he sets fire to himself in front of sparks this wave of total revolution and a different way of thinking about themselves is astonishing.
Yeah.
That power. And those themes are part of the story. You know, Christ, if anything, was a deeply divisive character. Mm. All revolutionaries are. Mm. Anybody who says that the established status quo is wrong and these values need to be questioned and this, you know, other way of thinking, try this other way of thinking, they're always going to be ridiculed and questioned and crucified in any way in which you want to define that.
Yeah.
They're bound to be divisive characters, and that's at the centre of the story as well.
Mm. Well, I guess the only criticisms I'd have of the film were that I thought Michael's resurrection at the end was a little bit too in your face. I would have preferred if it just had been as a meme, like the painting that we see at the end credits.
Yes.
And the other complaint I'd have is that I was expecting more animation by you. And I was wondering if that was something that you actually had to kind of pull back on, that you attempted to add more, but actually thought, no, I just want it to be reality. You know?
No, there was never going to be more animation. There was one moment for animation, and that's really there. Because I love it when you go to a film and you don't know what's going to be coming up.
Definitely.
Most of the time now, I go to films, very, very good films, and not so good films, but most films. And within the first couple of minutes, I know exactly the kind of images I'm going to be seeing. I know exactly the tone of the script. I pretty much know how it's going to pan out. Mm. You just know.
Yeah.
You know, the language of film and the templated nature of these stories, you know.
Mm.
Very rarely, very occasionally, you get a film like Being John Malkovich or, you know, Frida or something like this, that total Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, you really don't know where you're going to be. And I love that feeling. Mm. And I miss it. Mm. Because a lot of the films that I love from the past have that feeling. A lot of silent films have that feeling because they hadn't worked out the grammar of film properly yet.
Mm.
So, you know, that's there for that. The resurrection thing, I mean, that's interesting.
I mean, obviously the audience there were expecting it because otherwise it's not a Passion Play. But
there is that. I mean, it's really why many people will miss it.
Mm.
But there's a little scene just before the resurrection moment when it's in a care home. And we start the film in a care home.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just... I didn't want to adamantly... pedantically say this is the truth of what's going on. I just wanted to suggest that maybe this has all been happening within the minds of these elderly people at the ends of their lives, looking back over things. And I included a little headline from a possible newspaper. It's a little chink of a door opening into possibly what actually happened in the town, and everything we've seen is a mythologized version of that.
This is your second feature, and you've done three short films as well. You're better known as an artist and a graphic novelist. When it came to doing your first short and directing Mirror Mask, did directing come easily to you, or was it very much a collaborative process with the people around you?
No, it didn't come easily at all. And most of the other things I've tried, photography and writing and music, have come easier to me. I've found it very difficult, and I still don't really feel in control of it as a medium. And I don't know if this is true across the board, but my sense is that other people, like Michael Winterbottom, for example, they just seem to think in film. They just seem to be able to express themselves easily in film. Maybe if he was here, he would say, oh, don't worry. In my first few films, I didn't know what I was doing either. But I don't get that feeling. I get these Danny Boyle. Get the feeling that there's such an ease with which they seem to express themselves in film. I've never felt that, and I still don't. It gets a little easier.
But obviously you have a desire to make films, otherwise you wouldn't.
Well, I keep on banging my head against it because I'm determined not to be beaten by it. But I really love film. Mm. And so the short films I made were a way of trying to make films that felt like they were mine. Mm. Because unlike comics at the time, where I loved the medium, but there really weren't many comics, hardly any, being published that I really enjoyed. I thought, well, this is wide open territory. I'm sure I can do something that I hope people will like and be unusual. There have been so many amazing films made, so many great directors and whatever. You feel, well, you know, why bother? There's so many great ones out there. I didn't want to just add to the pile. I wanted to try and do something that was at least unusual. Whether people liked it or not, they couldn't deny that it wasn't unique or unusual. So my short films were just trying to find that language. And Miramas was trying to do that to a degree, but various things got in the way of that one. The gospel film in the end, even though strangely it's not my story, I had nothing to do with the actors, I had nothing to do with what was written, it's ended up being quite personal for me. So that one feels much more personal. Luna is more personal again. So I'm just trying to find films and ways of making films that are unusual and unique for me and express my feelings about films. I don't want a career as a director. I don't want to now go to Hollywood and try and make a Hollywood film, partly because I'm not really interested in doing that, and partly because I don't have the chops or the skills for that, partly because I don't see the point in that. There are lots of fantastic people in Hollywood doing those films. Let them do it. I'll do something else.
The Gospel of Us is touring select cinemas throughout the UK. To find out where, please go to www.nbcq.co.uk. That's nbcq.co.uk. And to find more information about Dave McKean's work, please go to his website www.davemckean.com. To hear my previous interview with Dave McKean about his collaboration with Richard Dawkins on his book The Magic of Reality, please go to my website www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Next, here's my interview with Steph Hutchinson about his new comic book, Demons 3, which is being packaged in two installments in the new Demons and Demons 2 Blu-ray releases from Arrow Films.
I'm talking to you tonight to discuss the Demons 3 comic that you've written.
Yes. Do you know the films well?
Yes, I mean, I've not seen them for a little while, but I remember them quite well. But in the first one, it's a group of kids watching a horror film in a cinema, and the demons on screen escape the celluloid world and start killing the audience. And then in the second one, it's pretty much the same setup, except the film is now being distributed on video, and people who are watching the video...
What's weird is it's almost like the second film's almost like a remake, because what you're watching on the... You know, in the way Evil Dead 2 sort of starts from the stage... The film that they're watching on TV in Demons 2 almost seems like a fictionalised version of the actual movie of Demons 1.
Huh.
It's, you know what I mean? It seems like a movie set in the aftermath of what happened.
Interesting.
It's bizarre. And the reason I'm saying that is because we've tried to sort of deal with that in the comic.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Japanese Ring franchise.
Yes, and Demons 2 is almost like a predecessor there, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was going to say, yeah. I mean, it seems to be very much predicting the sort of metatextuality of the Ring films.
I completely agree, and I actually introduced a screening of Demons 1 and 2 in Manchester a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things I did say about it, it's like a lot of 80s horror that's sort of more relevant there, but what I sort of said to introduce it, I threw out there that we could look at it as the Singing in the Rain of the horror movie franchise, you know, horror movies. You know, in that sort of same way that it deconstructs things in a really strange way. It's one of the things that's ahead of its time, really. But, I mean, you know, lest I give it too much credit, I'd say it's by accident.
So, yes, you're exploring... In the comic, something that's kind of suggested on film but not really delved into is the idea of the demons being a sort of virus that spread from one media to another. So in your comic, you talk about them starting off in a painting, then obviously in the films, they are a film and a video. And actually in the prologue to your comics, you even suggest that the comic itself could be infectious.
Yeah, because that was like an original idea for the storyline, but it didn't, you know what I mean? There wasn't enough there to make a full storyline from that, but it was too fun a thing to throw away completely, so I sort of used it in the advertising materials, because also it was tonally it's kind of different to the comic. Mm. The comics played straight a lot more.
And I was reading that when you were commissioned to do the comic, it had been a while since you'd seen the original Demons films, but having watched them again, you actually found it quite inspirational.
Yeah, I hadn't actually seen Demons when this came about. I had seen Demons 2, and we're going back a long time ago. It was one of those occasions where a friend's dad came back home from the flea market when we were kids with horror movies. All of them awful. The Unnameable, Burial Ground... Oh, it was called Knights of Terror, and Demons 2. And I didn't really like it. Mm. To be very honest about this, when I saw it, I didn't care for it. And I think that's a lot of that is because Italian horror, I was sort of schooled on sort of American horror as a kid, which is all very straightforward. Mm. Whereas Italian, plot's not important sort of thing. You know, it's very sort of mood, very surreal in a lot of sense, and very nightmare logic to it, where it sort of makes sense, but if you think about it too hard, it doesn't. And I didn't really sort of connect to that as a kid. But then if you come back another 10 years later, by which time I've gone through all of David Lynch and so forth, kind of liking it. So, yeah, we went back and, you know, it was a case of watching Demons, and I actually had a really fun time with it. Mm. Still don't love the second one because I think it's got really good set pieces. Mm. And I love the shot at the end of Sally running across the rooftop. I think that's a really beautiful and really freaky and disturbing shot. But it just lacked the punch of the first one. Mm. You know, I think it's the lack of gore really hurts it. The gore in Demons is integral to it. The sort of, you know, with the screen ripping and the flesh ripping, it all sort of works in this weird symmetry. And I think with the second one actually being, I believe, a made-for-television movie, which is why it doesn't have the gore content that the original does. Mm. Not that it's censored. And I think it does neuter it quite a bit. And it does repeat the ideas from the first one, but doesn't have the same sort of payoff. Mm. You know, and then it was a question of like, well, I still have to respect this, you know, I mean, there's nothing worse than someone coming in to write a tie-in that disrespects the source material. That would be the wrong reason to do it. And Jeff Zorno, the artist for it, he's actually a huge fan of the films. Mm. So I had a long chat with him. I'm like, what's important? And he's like, Bobby Rhodes. And I agree, but again, that didn't play into the tone. And it just came together through research. Going back to what you said about it being a virus, they mention, obviously, Nostradamus in the film, within a film, in the first Demons. That's the whole thing. It's his grave where they find the book, which obviously we see in the comic, how that got there in that reality. But it was interesting because when I started looking into it and doing the research, things started to come together just from pure historical ideas. For example, Nostradamus obviously was a doctor. He was originally a plague doctor. So that works quite nicely with the virus analogy straight away. Then, obviously, his teachings were, he learned Babylonian astrology from, you know, and that's one of the reasons why Catherine de' Medici, who appears in the comic, covered for him in a way when this was the time when, you know, he would have been classed as a heretic, a very dangerous time to be sort of talking prophecies. Then it turned out that he actually has got, from his quatrains, his verses, there's 46 already missing. So I start thinking, maybe that's the book that's in the film in Demons, the missing ones, and which it didn't end up being. It ended up being something different. But after going back to the Babylonian roots of his astrology, the actual city of Babylon in Iraq, when it was originally explored by the archaeologists towards the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, the majority of the things that they found there were looted and taken to, guess where? Berlin. Huh. Things where history sort of guides you. You know, it was because I just started reading wide and the notes, I started making notes, and then when you see these sort of patterns coming together, it throws you on the path that you're going to go with it.
Well, and talking of Iraq artifacts being kind of demonic in origin, that also links it to a German archaeologist in The Exorcist digging up an artifact and then releasing, you know, a demon on the west.
Demonic force, yeah. And in issue 2 of Demons 3, the first scene is in Iraq, modern day Iraq, with sort of a rogue group of American soldiers looking around, and they happen to find loads of the demon masks.
Mm.
You know, they're led there by the mysterious silver mask character from Demons.
Mm.
It's almost like some sort of prophet guiding them. So, you know, that came together quite well when we were actually doing it, really.
And I guess one of the things you wanted to explore in the comic was just who that person in the mask is.
Yes, yes. And I mean, that's something we've been very careful to actually cover up in the previews. Because also the guy who played him is Michelle Soavi, and Michelle Soavi is also the guy who puts the mask on, isn't he, in the film within a film.
Ah, okay.
And becomes the first demon on screen. So you've got this guy putting the mask on in these different sort of realities. So I nearly died a couple of weeks ago when someone saw the picture of the young man. And says, he looks just like me, which is supposed to, but I never thought anyone would click it.
Oh, that's funny.
It's one of the few times where I've not responded to the messages. And that's sort of a nice surprise and payoff for people at the end of the story.
Well, yes, I'll cover that bit up with White Noise in the podcast.
Yeah.
I hadn't realised that Michelle Soavi was the actor in the film, because that ties in, though, to one of the many unofficial sequels to Demons that was called Demon 3, in the sense that he directed The Church, which thematically does kind of work as a Demon sequel, but in the case, as was the case with many Italian horror films, they just thought, what have we got on the shelf that we can use as a cash-in to what we have that's successful?
Django Syndrome.
Indeed. I mean, did you watch any of the unofficial Demons 3, whether it's
No. I mean, I read about them, I read the outlines of them, and it just came down to one of those things like, I mean, if we're going to do a sequel to the first two films, then we need to focus on them. And I thought, if I actually watched the alternate sort of third films, then those ideas would end up seeping in there. Which is kind of not what we wanted to do, sort of keep it focused on the first two films, really. And also, not completely demystifying the two films, but I think you can go back and watch them now, and they actually kind of make sense after the comic.
Because you're talking about parallel worlds, and so that makes both Demons 1 and 2 things that can exist side by side rather than contradiction.
It sort of removes the continuity problems rather than trying to force them together, which a lot of sequels or prequels try and do that. They try and make them connecting the same, but these don't. I mean, these are sort of like realities just blending endlessly into one another through fiction. I guess it's like an ontological argument, just the idea is what allows something to be. And then you've got at the middle of this, you've got this sort of prophet who understands that every decision changes the future, and he can see all these millions of futures. It's, you know, unfortunately, no matter what he does, he's ultimately a gateway for it.
You said you hadn't watched that many Italian horror films. Have you caught up as an adult and grown to like at least some of them?
Yes, actually, yes. I mean, I'm very, very fond of Argento's work. Obviously, Suspiria stands out, and Inferno particularly. Yeah. I'd say, like, my favourite Argento's probably Tenebrae, which is probably one of his more literate ones. But even then, it's still got that dreamy quality in the way that whenever you have a murder sequence, it's like watching an 80s pop video. You know, it's really unusual. There's this beautiful sort of stylistic flourish over these kills, and I find that sort of stuff really, really interesting, because film studies is what I actually did at university, so I'm very much into that sort of aspect of them. The Beyond, I didn't like The Beyond when I first watched it. Now I absolutely adore it. Apart from the last act, I think it kind of fails a little bit when it becomes, when, oddly enough, I think it loses its way when it actually becomes a mainstream movie, when it becomes a zombie chase film. That's the least interesting part of it, but the very ending of The Beyond is fantastic. I think that's one of the all-time best horror endings.
Well, yeah, in terms of Italians making lyrical, surrealist horror films, I guess the Demons films are quite different to the rest of Argento's work, except perhaps the Three Mothers trilogy, and different to the rest of Lamberto Bava's work, which again is kind of following in his footstep of his father, in making Giallo.
Well, I think they're very focused on the American market, the Demons films. There's that sort of weird, where is this happening? They speak English in Berlin, with Italian actors. So there's a very strange sort of feel to it that works. But it's definitely, I think it's more targeted towards commercial sensibilities, really. It's a lot more accessible. It's certainly, it's when you watch it, it's only when you think about it that it doesn't make sense. If you just watch it and don't think about it, it's perfect. Whereas The Beyond demands some sort of thinking from you, because it's the idea of horror, or stealing it from the fantastic, being the idea of a hesitation between explanations, that weird zone that the mind goes to sometimes in nightmares where you cannot translate it into common sense or into familiar sort of narrative ideals. You can't do that, and you can, the beyond, it doesn't fall apart, it just refuses, whereas demons sort of falls apart a little bit because it's halfway towards being a conventional narrative, I think. Maybe. All the thinking, I don't know.
And in terms of your career as a comic book writer, I guess your way into comics was that you made the documentary about the 25th anniversary of Halloween, yeah, and then were commissioned to write Halloween comics after that?
Before that.
Oh, okay.
Very early on, after I finished uni, I went to Canada. Back in 1999, we all tried to get a zombie movie off the ground because our argument then was, nobody makes zombie movies anymore. You know, if we only pull that off. But, you know, we got a lot of attention, we got lots of people interested and didn't get a frame of film. So, you know, there were just lots of sort of failed attempts to try and sort of make something happen. And then when the convention was happening, I just got in touch with them and I said that would be kind of fun because a few friends and I had talked about doing a road trip from Canada to LA and maybe we'll finish there. And it ended up developing into a documentary on the film series. As soon as we started getting more, you know, people listed, I guess listed, it sort of became an obvious one, really. I was never completely happy with how that turned out, but at the same time, I got in touch with Compass about doing a Halloween comic, because previously they'd been done by Chaos Comics, and Chaos, I believe, had gone bankrupt, so no one had picked up the license from that point. And they basically gave me a go-ahead to do a book with the intention of using that to market it as a series to a publisher. So we self-published a book called One Good Scare back in 2003. And that got really, really good reviews, but unfortunately we didn't have distribution, so we lost a fortune on the thing. But we did get distribution, well, people interested in putting them out as a series, but then, just as that happened, there was a big legal battle within the Halloween ranks. So we were forced to weigh all of this out. And then when it actually came for the documentary to actually be released 3 years later in 2006, one of the things I wanted to do just to get interest rolling in was put a comic book in there. So we had Autopsis in there, and then we ended up with Devil's Due Publishing. So we did Night Dance, first 30 Years of Terror, and First Death of Laurie Strode, which was never completed because we had the horrible bad luck of Devil's Due getting into financial problems, and the books were selling, but the money wasn't coming through to everyone. So it was again, another miserable experience at the end of it, but at least I got to put some of the stories out, which was nice.
Do you think you could ever resolve the issues with the rights holders and maybe do a graphic novel of all of the Halloween comics you've done?
It would be good. It just depends on what the situation's with stuff that was published at Devil's Due, really. I've got a very good relationship with the Halloween people. You know, it's gone on well for a long time, and I've just been developing a drama script, not a horror script, but this big historical drama for Malika Card, who runs Compass and Tranker. So we've been working together on that. So it's just one of those things, we'll have to sit down and think, can we make this work? Can we get it all out? And also, can we do it and sort of look after the people who were messed around a bit last time? I mean, like Jeff the artist, he's owed quite a lot of money from Devil's Due. And realistically, we're never going to see that. But it's the artist, it hurts more than the writers, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of time put into drawing a comic.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating, especially with, like, for example, Laurie Strode. First step, Laurie Strode, we finished the book, but the final issue didn't come out, and there's nothing more frustrating than having something done that you've created and you're happy with and people not seeing it. You know, you want people to see it. That's one of the payoffs of it. Whether they like it or not, it's one of the joys of it. I don't mind if I get a bad review. That's not a problem. At least someone's read it. And it's sort of uncomfortable knowing that you've got these people who supported you and bought the first two issues and haven't got the third because it's not out.
Yeah.
And that sort of sits not very well with me at all, really. And it's, here's hoping, anyway. I mean, the material's there. It's all plotted out. And in the case of that story, it's finished. So maybe, you know, we'll get lucky and we'll get it out in the world.
Oh, fingers crossed. I mean, at least you've gotten to work with Jeff again on this project, so presumably...
Yeah, I mean, and we're talking about, like, what we can do in terms of create our own stuff, because that's obviously the next step, really, to sort of get away from the licensed material a little bit. And don't get me wrong, I love writing licensed books. It's really, really good, especially when you're playing in, like, the sort of playground that you grew up in, where, you know, because Halloween was one of those sort of seminal films along the way. And Demons, again, was a new experience to me when I actually went to watch the first one, but there was loads there. I mean, that's the thing. It's a story of demons travelling through different realms, so there's endless ways you can do it. And that's exciting. You know, it's often a lot easier, actually, to write when you haven't got freedom. the more restrictions you have on the story sort of make it easier to find the place within it.
Yeah.
And when someone says to you, write me a story, any story, that's really difficult. Where do we go from here sort of thing?
Yeah. And I guess the other connection that your Halloween comics have with this Demons 3 comic is that you're exploring gaps in the narrative that, you know, the mythology of the Demons films isn't fully explored on screen. And with the Halloween franchise, Halloween H2O, which I think was the strongest sequel that they did, contradicts the previous films, because, you know, it's all very well that Laurie Strode faked her death to go into police custody, but at the same time, she wouldn't kind of abandon her daughter, you know?
No, and there's a lot of different, you know, and it's not like when you break H2O down, there's loads and loads of things that fly in the face of 4, 5, and 6. And there's also a very strange moment where it can't tell whether it's a sequel to 1 or 2. you know, because it says that he vanished off into the night, but then it's got the sister aspect, which was a Halloween 2 thing.
Mm.
So what we did with the comics, we actually sort of went with what they'd done with H2O, where they basically retconned 4, 5, and 6 out of existence.
Mm.
And, you know, whatever you think of the virtues of those films, I understand why they did it, because they got so far away from the simplicity that made the first film work.
Mm.
I mean, I remember when we were interviewing, I think it was Mark Shapiro, the Fangoria writer, about Halloween. He was saying, going back to Bava, actually Mario Bava's visual style is very much reflected in Halloween.
Mm.
You know, it's very... I don't know if expressionistic is the word, but there's a lot of shadow play. It looks very much to me like a colour version of Night of the Hunter.
Okay.
And it's also got the same thing going on that Night of the Hunter's got, where you've got a supposedly human villain, yet he represents and seems to feel like something out of a really bad dream.
Mm.
He's part of the environment, and there's something really doesn't make sense, and you can't put your finger on it. And Halloween very much carries that with Michael Myers. Well, The Shape, we'll say, I think. And... you know, we'll go with The Shape, because Halloween 2 is where they first give him the motive. You know, he wants to kill his other sister. And as soon as you do that, he's not The Shape anymore. At that point, he is Michael Myers. You know, he's a guy with sister issues. And it really takes, for me personally, I know a lot of people would disagree with me, but for me, that takes away so much. If anything, there should never have been a sequel to Halloween, because that ending is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, evil goes on. It's out there. This horrible force is out there in the night, and no one can stop it. Mm. The end.
Well, and the fact that he's so indestructible as well, you know, if you start trying to explain that, it doesn't work.
That's it, and that's the thing, when with, you know, with Halloween 4, they extended it into not just him chasing a sister, it became Bloodline with Jamie, who's one of the most likable characters in the series, so I understand why people are attached to those movies. And plus, you've got a lot of Donald Pleasance going crazy, and that's mesmerising to watch. I love Loomis in any of the films.
Mm.
But you're getting, the more you go down that path, you're getting so far away from the boogeyman sort of aspect. And when I wrote One Good Scare, that was directly after Halloween Resurrection, so I felt that I was almost obliged to make amends for it.
Indeed.
So I just went with something really simple and dark, and went with my take on it. I had to make a decision here and go with my gut on it.
Yeah.
I think if you don't do that, you're doing your readers a disservice. You've got to go with it. I think if you write it to placate readers, you're going to end up with a crop of shit. They'll do exactly what they expected. I'm not the biggest fan of the Chaos comics, but I understand why people do like them, because the three issues are just straight exposition on the mythology. It's for fans who want to know facts and facts and facts. But that was never what attracted me to the series. It was the mystique. So I made him more of... I went back to the idea of him being a trick-or-treater, which you see lots of in the original film. Everything that I sort of used, like there were signs for it. Like, for example, Laurie, if he didn't want Laurie Strode to see him in that first film, he wouldn't have done. He always appears until she sees him and then disappears. That's part of it. You know, I think there's a sadism there, because nobody else sees him, only his prime target. And if you watch the first film, he's never chasing her because it's his real sister. It's more via a sort of identification. I think the description on the VHS box in the 80s said, Michael Myers has returned home to relive his crime. And that's pretty much what it was. Laurie Strode's the first person to turn up at the Myers house, and suddenly there's this fixation, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, just by the misfortune of being there. And also, you know, she drops the key on the porch. And if you want to talk about symbolism, going right the way back to your classical stories, that's pure fairy tale right there. And one thing I've always said to people is, when you watch Halloween, the story is Little Red Riding Hood remade. All the way through, from, you know, the wolf encountering her, and obviously she's the only female character that encounters him along the way. the others don't. And then, you know, when he's hiding in Grandma's house, well, he's hiding in her friend's house where all her friends are dead and displayed. Comes after her, and right at the end, you've got the woodcutter pretty much turning up and shooting him. Loomis turns up pretty much in the same way as the original story. The woodcutter turns up with the axe and saves everybody. So, and I think that's why it works, because it's on classic sort of archetypes, really, whereas when you get to Halloween 5 and they're bringing in tattoos, and then obviously poor old Dan Fiennes, when he wrote 6, had to sort of make all this work, and you've got this massively elaborate story of cults teaching him to drive. I think you're getting away from what Carpenter was doing drastically. I mean, you know the line in the first film where Loomis sort of says, how did he get out of here? You know, someone says he can't drive, and Loomis just goes, he was doing very well last night.
Indeed.
I think that's a great in-joke, just to say, if that's the sort of explanation you want, this isn't the right film. It's a scare machine, first and foremost, so the plot, almost like an Italian film, becomes secondary to what the film's actual objective is, and that's to scare the shit out of you.
Cool. All right, well, hopefully your unreleased Halloween comic will see air at some point, and that you do more comics in the future.
Yeah, that's the plan. So ideally would like to work towards getting a film out there, so fingers crossed, but it's, you know how it is. It's just you keep knocking and knocking and knocking until someone answers the right door.
The two comic books which comprise Demons 3 can be found in the Demons and Demons 2 Blu-ray editions coming out from Arrow Films on the 14th of May. For more information, please go to www.arrowfilms.co.uk. And to read the 3-page prologue comic, please go to tinyurl.com/demons3. Although not to do with comics, between May the 1st and May the 7th, Sci-Fi London, London Science Fiction and Fantastic Film Festival, is taking place at the Apollo Piccadilly Cinema, the BFI South Bank, and BAFTA Cinema Piccadilly, with various film premieres including Death, True Love, Cycle, The Captains with William Shatner, Philip K. Dick's Radio Free Albemuth, Clone starring Matt Smith, and many more taking place over the week. I'll be conducting Q&As with the directors of several of those films, and for more information, please go to www.scifilondon.com. If you enjoy the intersection between film and comics, then every month on our website, www.electricsheepmagazine.com, we have a review of a recent DVD or Blu-ray release done in comic strip format. These range from the absurdist anime review Little Pet Shop of Horrors by David O'Connell, in which the Queen Mother discusses the highs and lows of the animated series, to manga-influenced reviews, such as Rebecca Burgess's take on Quatermass and the Pit, to thoughtful and involved monochrome strips over several pages that even include animation, such as John Spelling's review of The Twilight Zone. For all of these, please go to the review section on our website and click on Comic Strip Reviews. The Electric Sheep Magazine podcast was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and there'll be a new episode online next month. Thanks for listening.